This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. Thank you for joining us today. So here's the Trump tweet that we're following. It's not about Meryl Streep at the Golden Globes. No, this one is from Saturday, and it says, having a good relationship with Russia is a good thing, not a bad thing. Only stupid people or fools would think that it's bad. Donald Trump continued, both countries will perhaps work together to solve some of the great many pressing problems and issues of the world, in all caps. Now, Donald Trump is not the first U.S. leader to look for a Russia reset. President Obama did it. George W. Bush famously looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and saw that he had a good soul. That feeling didn't last very long. Donald Trump's counselor, Kellyanne Conway, meanwhile, says we should ignore the tweets and the statements and that we can look into Donald Trump's soul.
You always want to go by what's come out of his mouth rather than look at what's in his heart.
Kellyanne Conway on CNN. In his heart, Donald Trump believes that Russian meddling in the election had, as he says, absolutely no effect on the outcome. And that sounds like Donald Trump peering into the hearts of voters to know what helped them make up their minds. But he's also doubted whether Russia meddled at all.
The Russians intended to meddle, and they meddled.
The Russians are clearly a big adversary, and they demonstrated it by trying to mess around in our election.
President Obama on This Week on ABC and Mitch McConnell on CBS. Well, a lot of Washington, including the 17 agencies of the intelligence community, disagree with the president-elect. Here's incoming White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, and he said as much on Fox News Sunday.
We have had bad actors, including the Russians. But we also have a problem when we have a major political institution that allows foreign governments into their system with hardly any defenses or training.
Well, Donald Trump says that he's going to formulate a hacking response within 90 days of taking office. Still, Russian hacking has revealed not only vulnerabilities at the DNC, surely, but a U.S. government slow to respond to a growing threat, one that's cheap and easy to use with often little discernible downside for a lot of actors. David Sanger is here. He's national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. David, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you, Todd.
So you've been writing about the slowness. You call it the analog response to a digital problem. And U.S. intelligence officials were in front of senators last week complaining of the same thing. But what are they really saying? That they want more speed in how to respond to not only hacks, but then the use of this information. But they're also acknowledging that there's a brand new matrix here. It's kind of one where there's low risk but high potential of reward for smaller state actors like in Iran or in North Korea, where there's not a whole lot of downside to trying and trying and trying again.
That's right. We've got two different issues here. Number one is cyber is perfect for broke countries like Russia or North Korea or those that are revenue constrained like Iran. This is cheaper than drones, right? And you can reach across borders and it's deniable. Something we had going against us here was not early detection. In fact, we reported on Friday that with the help of the British, the U.S. was alerted to the DNC hack by the early fall of 2015. But President Obama said he first heard about it in early summer of 2016. The FBI did not escalate this with the DNC, and the DNC didn't even alert its own leadership. So we had months that went by in which the hacking took place, and no one was thinking about a response or even putting together the bigger picture. So the problem here wasn't technological. It was a failure of imagination and a failure of response time on the part of the U.S. government.
Was there a failure of imagination by the time this did surface to the president in the early summer before the election? Because he chose not to respond at that time, of course.
Yeah.
At least
so
publicly.
That's right. He understood what was going on pretty well. He did do a warning in private to President Putin at a meeting they had. They were both attending in China in September. But then they got bollocksed up in another problem, which was that President Obama was concerned that if he publicly called out the Russians and did sanctions, they would respond before Election Day or maybe on Election Day by trying to affect the vote tallies. And secondly, I think he was concerned about appearing to be too political. In other words, doing this to side with Hillary Clinton, which certainly Donald Trump would have accused him of. In fact, even today, Donald Trump makes the argument that this is all about politics and it's all driven by the pro-Hillary camp and so forth. Many Republicans don't agree with him, but that's the case he's making. So I think President Obama, absent a political campaign in which he feared being accused of coming down on one side, probably would have reacted sooner.
David Sanger, we've been having more and more conversations on this show about cyber deterrence and what it means to deter or to disincentivize, I suppose, you know, this type of activity. Do you have any sense that officials, planners, agents within the government are starting to get their heads around what deterrence means in this new age?
Well, certainly there are a lot of academics who've been working on this for a long time, and the NSA has as well. And I think if you look around the country, you've got groups of scholars getting together now to try to figure out how do you deter cyber attacks. Much as in the 1950s, you saw scholars get together to try to figure out how do you deter nuclear attacks. The difference is that almost everything that works in nuclear doesn't work in cyber. They're completely different weapons, the dynamics completely different, the cost basis is different. And of course, with a cyber attack, you can dial it up and dial it down. And what's been fascinating about the North Korea hack against Sony, the Russian hack in this case, and many of the others, is they've been just below that level that would trigger a military response. And so people know they can use this and likely get away with it.
Well, all of this, of course, is taking place in a broth of politics. There's no question about that. So David, can you and I just run a quick kind of political check on the claims that get made after action?
Sure.
Here? I mean, Donald Trump says over and over that there was absolutely no impact on the outcome of this election. Even Donald Trump's critics in Congress, people like Lindsey Graham, say it didn't change the outcome. That strikes me as a completely meaningless and unknowable statement, any more than saying it swung the outcome. It's just not knowable. That's part of the point, I think.
That's right. It is unknowable. It is true that we've seen no evidence that the Russians hacked into the system to tally the votes. And I think that when Mr. Trump turns out these tweets and makes these statements, that's what he's referring to. What we don't know, and we'll never know, is how many people decided not to vote for Hillary Clinton because they read a John Podesta email or they saw the stuff from the DNC or whatever. And would that in the end have made a quantifiable difference? And even the intelligence report that came out on Friday said, we didn't even look at this issue. This is beyond the realm of what U.S. intelligence agencies do. We don't do political analysis inside the United States. So it is unknowable.
And not academic in Europe, which is getting ready for a whole round of elections in Germany and France and already have signs that similar, if not identical, weaponized information use is happening there.
Absolutely. And I think that's going to be a significant issue in Europe. And we've already seen in the German election some of these same techniques begin to come out. I'm sure you'll see it in France. And, of course, we already saw it in Ukraine and the Baltics and so forth.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks, David.
Thanks, Todd.
I'm David Remnick, host of The New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.